Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. Tim, Michael, Mo, and the occasional guest discussing digital analytics issues of the day. Find them on Facebook at facebook.com/analyticshour and their website analyticshour.io. And now, the Digital Analytics Power Hour.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. This is episode 93. As you look back on your illustrious analytics career and you think about the metrics and the trend lines that brought you the most success, was it a big increase in time on site or maybe a big drop in bounce rate, or was it doubling that site conversion rate? Whatever the scenario, we all have our way of handling the analysis we do. And sometimes the common pattern is the one that pays out over and over again. And sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's a trap. But that's what we're going to talk about. We've got practical tips, maybe. So let's introduce the host of the show, Tim Wilson.
Hold on.
Goes wild.
Sorry, I was checking. I was busy checking the time on site for analyticshour.io. So I was a little, little delayed.
Time on site.
Our KPI.
And Mo Kiss.
Hey, how's it going?
And Michael Helbling. That's me. All right. Yeah, let's start with what's your favorite metric and why? I'm just kidding.
If you were a metric, what metric would you be?
So
I'd be bounce rate. Most of my social interactions.
Do you have a high propensity to bounce?
I would be incremental revenue.
I'd definitely be engagement, some type of engagement metric for sure.
Oh, right. Okay, so this is the idea. Like, I was reading on the Measure Slack a while ago, and I saw a conversation happening around how people were thinking of measuring something. And I think it had something to do with fallout reporting. I don't really remember the exact thing, but it got me thinking about, I think over the years, there's been this establishment of kind of different ways of doing analysis, or in a certain sense, different things that we analyze. Like the website itself is a kind of a system that we analyze, and the campaigns that are feeding the traffic in are part of that system. And it's all about kind of like optimizing and pulling the right levers. And then over here, we also have like the analysis we do around who our customers are and, you know, all of the values that they have and what is their loyal, you know, churn, what is their LTV, what is their propensity to buy, like all of these kinds of things. And then even on the product side, if we're a product company, and I usually kind of equate content to product if you're not a product company. So you're looking at the effectiveness of your content, or you're looking at the effectiveness of your product, and there's a lot of evaluation you're doing of those. And so I don't know. It just got me thinking along the lines of like, is that kind of how people do that? And does that ring true for you guys, or how would you kind of approach the way to categorize, I guess, sort of, you know, primary ways of doing analysis?
So I think we all do wind up coming in both. Well, one, we're taking whatever baggage or history we have of what has worked or been successful in the past. Like, so I definitely have data that I'm way more comfortable with, and therefore I want to, that's my hammer. And I mean, I would say like web analytics data, way more comfortable with than maybe next to that is CRM data. You get into, I don't know, fulfillment or inventory data. I'm like, what the hell is this? So I think we have there's always going to be a human bias to go to the data that you understand. But then I also think, as much as we talk about breaking down silos, kind of as you set that up, I was thinking how often in an organization, if you are an analyst on the e-commerce team because you have an e-commerce organization, then chances are you're more likely to skew around the things that you can specifically control, the e-commerce experience, and you're going to try to analyze the crap out of that data, even if you know, or you've been told, you know, Jim Novo beat it into you, or it just came up somewhere else, that really you should be stepping back and thinking about the whole customer. But a lot of times organizations don't, you know, a lot of analysts, I don't think necessarily feel empowered. If I'm supposed to be working on optimizing the e-commerce experience. And I'm like, well, hold on, let's talk about lifetime value of our customers, which could bridge to that, because you could say, well, I don't want to just generically optimize my checkout process for everyone. I want to have some sense of the whole customer. But that's a really, really tough leap to make. One, because you have to get data from a much deeper area, and two, you sort of may feel like you're getting, you know, stepping beyond what you're supposed to be doing. I don't know if that's kind of on the same line.
Doesn't that just mean that we're bad at our jobs? I mean, if we're kind of like, if we're saying, okay, we're part of, okay, literally take me as an example, part of the checkout team that looks after the checkout process, and I go through, yes, part of my job is helping improve that checkout. But if I'm not good at taking a step back and saying, where does this fit as like a bigger piece of the puzzle, then I just am not very competent.
I tend to think of it as having an opportunity to improve in our jobs, Mo.
Well, but I think that's actually, you're bringing up that there is the, what has been handed to the analyst is the scope of their role. And in some companies, that's a pretty tight box, and it's, this is what you need to do. In other companies, it's like, hey, this is some general guidelines, but hey, if you have an idea or you want to pursue something else, and yeah, that means this other stuff needs to be shifted around on priorities, you know, go to it. So I think there can be organizationally, I suspect it skews towards the larger, older, you know, pre-digital companies. We've talked about this in the past, are more likely to struggle to say, wait a minute, let's step back and take a strategic, higher level view and figure out, where should we be looking? And let's get the right people who have the skills to look into it, regardless of where they sit organizationally. I think that happens a lot more in the younger and more digitally, you know, digital native organizationally companies, perhaps. But
okay, so just pause. So if I'm trying to understand checkout experience so that my team can ultimately improve it, that's my box or remit, so to speak, however we want to refer to it. And I go through the checkout process and I see that there's different issues and drop-off points and people struggling with different things. Absolutely, one of the things I'm going to do is go talk to our customer service analyst and also see what complaints have we had about the checkout. Now, that's completely outside of my remit, but isn't that, I mean, are there actually companies where someone would be like, no, get back in your box. You're not allowed to look at customer service data. What are you, crazy? Is that actually a thing?
I think there are companies that the customer service analyst that you went to talk to would say, I've been doing this for 25 years. I'm not in the business of providing you with data. I absolutely think that would be the case. I mean, there are plenty, because that's another good point, though. That there are plenty of analysts who aren't necessarily intrinsically motivated, awesome employees who just want to do the right and best thing. If you're collaborating with somebody who kind of stumbled into a role of an analyst and maybe aren't a great fit, then they can be a real, you know, barrier to what you're doing. And if you say, hey, let's collaborate and do this awesome thing, yeah, there are definitely companies where people are like, wait, are you going to make me look bad? Wait, right. Is this something I should be doing? Is it get out of my back, you know, get off my lawn? That's my area. Absolutely, that exists in organizations.
Thank you for tying us right back into episode one of the podcast.
Wow.
No, that's good. I also think or ponder, and again, like, I've got more questions than answers for sure. So maybe I'm like interviewing you two. Like, I ponder sort of like almost like a generational divide, if you will. Like, Tim, you and I are old and
older,
more mature. Let's just say it seasoned. That way. And seasoned. Yeah, seasoned.
More grizzled. Borderline rancid. Turning.
Yeah. Yeah, we're ripe. So, but like back in our day, right, there weren't like really great explanations of how to get at some of this stuff or how to skip over stuff that was dumb or wrong. In fact, there's probably examples we could go to from the early days of analytics where people were literally screaming at us to focus on bounce rate as a primary way of understanding our website's performance. And I don't mean to pick on any certain person because they've certainly updated their, you know, conversation on topic since. But like, I think for us analysts back then, we had a lot less to work with. And I think it also like, and I want your perspective, Mo, on this as well, is, you know, because I've heard you mention kind of, you know, as an analyst coming in, sometimes you feel like you didn't waste time with sort of maybe the, I don't know how to describe it, like the old world style of tools, like the legacy tool sets, if you will, like the reporting tools or the descriptive tools. Like, well, I don't know. What are you guys' thoughts?
Yeah, I do. I hear what you're saying, but the funny thing is it's almost like things are going, I don't want to say backwards because they're not backwards, but there's a trend going through the industry right now of instead of doing sort of really polished data warehouses where you have a really amazing ETL process and your data is spat out super clean, people are starting to go back to that data lake, like let's just pump in things in very raw, pretty crass formats, and let's let the analysts figure it out at the other end. And there are lots of companies making this move at the moment. And so when you talk about, yeah, like we used to have log files and we used to do this, and I kind of feel like sometimes we're going back to that. It's going to be less polished. We definitely have more data and we have more sources of data that we can look to, but we're almost kind of starting to do a full loop back to like, here's something really messy and you guys need to figure out how to make useful stuff of it rather than spending this huge amount of time cleaning and prepping it.
I think the big difference is that when it was purely log files, 8 times out of 10, it was, no, we don't capture that. We don't have that data.
Yeah.
And then the separate, to me, what I kind of hearken back to is just the kind of misguided naivete. And I'll agree that there is still misguided naivete today, but back was, hey, we want to just look at the past through our site. That was kind of the perception from the business was there were common paths through the site that even if you just spent 2 minutes of critical thinking about, so what? You know, if there is, great, it's there. You're not going to change it. If there aren't, then it's, which it always was, is it's a freaking hot mess. What are you going to do? You actually need to turn around and think about the business side first. And I still, and we've talked and we're still trying to get somebody on to really talk about data lakes versus data warehouses. Mm-hmm. I equate the, oh, you know what? Just throw everything in a data lake and we'll figure it out later. Isn't always the right solution, but it gets treated as a panacea. The tag everything and capture everything isn't a panacea. The deep learning, we're going to deep learning the shit out of everything. There's still this hunger from the business that I don't think has changed, which is either the technology or the analyst are going to magically make simple and black and white something from, we've always thought that we've had an enormous amount of data because we always have. We've always had way more data than we had 2 years before. And that just continues to grow. And then it's only the benefit of hindsight that we say, oh, things were so nice when we just had a website and nobody had a smartphone. Our data collection was kind of crappier and certainly the processing power was much, much worse. But I don't think that's fundamentally changed, that there's a big class of people we're serving who really say, you analysts, just dig into the data and give me an answer. And maybe that's where still my go-to bias is. I absolutely want to sit and talk and think and ideate and hypothesize and use all sorts of other buzzwords and not think that, oh, we're just going to get to some, you know, kind of technical nirvana.
Yeah. I mean, here's a good little question for you, Mo. In your career as an analyst, have you ever had someone ask you to get them a report of the least viewed pages of the website?
Interesting. Actually, I've had that happen. I've had that happen once.
Oh, well, never mind then.
We were considering getting rid of a section of our website. So we actually looked at how low the usage was versus other sections of the website. And we did actually find that almost no one went there and used it. So we got rid of it. So
that's an actual, no, but that's like a real business purpose for asking that question.
Yeah.
As opposed to
absolutely.
People who, in addition to seeing the most viewed pages, would also like to see on a regular basis the least viewed page.
On this topic, though, when you have a question that that someone in the business asks you, do you have this like list of primary go-to things that you check first? Like, is that just how you operate?
It's not as scientific as all that, although I struggle with this because I really think there are standards we could find and set out there. I just don't think I'm smart enough to do it, is really what it comes down to. So Gary Angel, if you're listening, please define some standards.
I have some go-to. Anytime somebody asks me a question, literally as soon as I can, I go through the experience myself, which is often the people asking the question have not. I mean, and it's like, that's, I swear, 10% of the time, I'm like, the answer is go through your own fucking experience and you'll see where the problem is. Because of that, I also kind of tend to have a go-to of what is my breakdown by device category, because I'm still convinced that even though we're on the eighth year of it's the year of mobile, we sit at our desktops and we look at experiences and we say, oh, we built them as responsive, therefore I'm set. And yet the business still, and I mean, unless they're looking at a mobile app, they still are internally, they're always visiting when they're sitting at their desk. So, and I mean, I can't count the number. It's happened this week where they're like, you know, wow, what's going on here? I'm like, well, 90% of your traffic is on mobile, and let me do a screen capture of what this looks like on my iPhone. So, I mean, I will say, I mean, it's not every question is different, but those big movers of what can be the mobile tends to be one where I feel like, because that's not something people know. They know they built it for mobile, but they don't necessarily know what the traffic mix is. And if it skews really heavily, then that just can open up a whole range of ideas. And then the second thing is kind of traffic source, because even though the reporting sort of treats them as parallel, we know that every traffic source is so fundamentally different. So that's kind of, you know, before the show, we were talking, you were saying, you know, promotions, like that's going to be a go-to. Something goes crazy, you're going to be like, okay, what did we do? You know, what did we do to drive? So I will say those do tend to operate pretty consistently.
I guess that's true. Like, I think one of my first things to do is to seek to eliminate a data quality question. So if somebody's
asked, which is another part of going through the site, actually saying, what are we capturing?
Yeah. Are we capturing the data wrong? Is it broken? How are we capturing that particular
Helps, that would be one of your first steps.
Yeah, because that's going to tell me whether or not we have a data quality problem. And then I can dig into segmentation and looking at different sources and those kinds of things after I figure out if there's just a big broken thing on the website.
I'm
a consultant most of the time.
Right.
And so I'm not talking about my website. I'm talking about their website. Yeah. And so that's way different, right? Because obviously in the environment where, like, say when I was working on the client side, I knew our website inside and out and knew exactly where things were broken and weren't broken over the years. And so that wouldn't be my first thing to do. But then in that scenario, I had, like you had, I looked at channels. What was the last night's email? What other campaigns are we running? What products are on sale? Like, and I would just go through my list and I would leverage my secret internal daily dashboard that I built basically to tell me all those things so that I could like know at a moment's notice what was impacting all of the key metrics that we had.
Isn't it funny though? Like, we really are biased, because as you guys are talking about channels, I've been sitting on the customer product side for so long. I'm like, that's one of the last places I would look at, because once they get to my site, in some pieces of analysis, how they got there is really important. But ultimately, like, if, for example, I saw conversion rate was performing really badly and I wanted to understand, like, did we have a different mix of traffic than we would normally with less propensity to purchase?
That just means a huge uptick in display advertising.
But like, it wouldn't be my go-to. It would be something, it would be one of the things I was checking if something was going wrong, probably more. But I guess that is bias.
But I think even that's like knowing internally sort of how your operations work. And so there's a little bit is the company. Yeah. If you have a very fragmented company where there's no communication between the email, between display, between paid search, and you're like, you know what? Every time something goes wacky, it's somebody did something and they didn't track it well, or they didn't, you know, So whereas if you're like, look, I generally know what rhythm we run on and we generally have coordinated campaigns, I do think there's a big difference that a lot of times when I'm getting brought in, it's, hey, can you take a look at this? We think X is weird. And there is kind of a, maybe a lot of what I'm doing is kind of the, what's the ramp up to just get the lay of the land for what's going on here so that you don't just assume something is kind of typical or normal. So I think that's a good point, but that's one of the advantages. That's one of the upsides of being in-house and not a client, or a, you're not repeating that, let me get the lay of the land process again and again. And therefore you probably do jump to a deeper, smarter question much more quickly.
I'm not sure it is. It's like, why did it go up? Why did it go down? Like, that's the question. Which...
No. But you're like what it might have been. You'll get to a second order level of actually answering the question. Not necessarily right. The question, but the answer to the question or investigation of the question.
Right. And that's where like things, you know, like I mentioned Gary Angel earlier, but like actually one of the things that he and his team pioneered in the industry, not that other people didn't do it, but I think he kind of documented it for everybody, was this concept of two-tiered segmentation. And sort of as a practice, try to leverage multiple layers of segmentation to drive into a better understanding of exactly what was the drivers were. And that's very helpful. And but when you start out, you're just, you know, I remember an experience of looking at the website's conversion rate in aggregate and just wondering what to do, you know? And it's like, now that's funny because, well, of course, you start breaking it down and finding out what's driving it and all those things. But that's, you've got to learn from something. Okay, I want to turn another gear. We're going to create another layer of intensity. No, I don't know what we're doing. We're just sort of going down. Everything we've talked about so far have been what I would label descriptive. Right? Backwards looking analysis. Why did this happen? What's broken? So then what about as we take the next step and we start to leverage predictions? So how do we apply the same level of thinking? Are there standards? Are there common approaches when we predict the future and how we do that? And I know that I'm leaving myself behind because this is probably the work I've done the least of in my career so far as an analyst, because I stopped being an analyst and started being a whatever I do now. And so let's work more for you two. But like, do we see the same things at the same kind of pattern where we're kind of leveraging what we know to then create that prediction? Or is it a whole new ball game in that space?
I think there's still very little prediction. I think to me, what I mostly see is that when you're saying prediction, you're trying to figure out if I do X, what will happen in the future. Like web analysts or digital analysts are not necessarily getting asked to forecast traffic unless it's like, hey, the IT team wants to make sure they can handle the holiday load or something.
And for a great primer on how to forecast your traffic, please refer to our Bayesian episode with LA Fight. Thank you. Okay.
And asymmetric loss for the win.
That's right.
But I think that sort of marches over to the A/B testing and multivariate testing of saying, you know, the conceptually simple way to predict the future is to run the future in parallel, you know, a test and control, and say, therefore, I am predicting. Now you get in huge slippery slope when you say, well, what is this lift? Multiply this out. That's super dangerous, and plenty of people kind of rage against that. But I don't feel like this idea of saying we want to, you know, media mix modeling is saying if you make these changes, we will forecast that you will see such and such of a difference in your revenue or your ROI from your marketing spend. I don't know, Mo, how often do you run into as we've now established as the more sophisticated analyst on this podcast, are you doing things you would classify as prediction?
Yeah, we do. We definitely do have to do a bit of it. I don't know. I mean, we're a little bit odd because we have this concept of the full stack analyst where we all do a bit of data engineering, we all do a bit of data science, and we all do a bit of data analysis. And it's something that I wrestle with actually internally quite a bit, is because for me, I'm always like, okay, I'm going to look at all of my past data and use that to help me learn what's going to happen next. But then, and I can't even remember where I was, someone was talking about this exact concept that you can't assume that's what has happened in the past is going to happen in the future. And so it's something I'm always wrestling with and trying to learn more about. How do you do better predictions? But I mean, it's something when it comes to predicting, it's definitely something that I'm learning more about, and we're going to have to, as analysts, get better at that. I don't think we can keep spending our days looking, just reporting on what's happened in the past. We need to have that forward looking of being like, okay, well, this promotion performed this way. We have similar circumstances, except we have this extra stock or we have this extra whatever. So we can expect that it's going to perform that way. So I do think we need to spend more time in that space, but it's also tough because the business still expects you to be reporting on the past as well.
Well, but there's... It's not like, and I get a little twitchy when there was the CEO of a large voice of customer company who just loved every time he presented, he talked about that we're not going to look in the rear view mirror. I mean, that's like the most hackneyed cliche, like there's no value in the rear view mirror. And I'm like, bullshit, you know, like looking conceptually, yeah. Looking back. So from a, yes, you want to be looking at your historical data. That's the data you have available to learn what worked and didn't work. To then, to the extent that you can, infer why that might be, and therefore make recommendations of how this could be better, which is still making decisions going forward. So you're impacting decisions. That, to me, is kind of different from actually saying, and we've managed to, and maybe we do need to get to this point of, because we've managed to break all this stuff down, although it's really, really messy with the number of different variables and changing consumer behavior and changing experiences and competitors changing things, to say, if you, on this next campaign, somehow you need to have a bunch of really messy historical data and say, do this X thing that is specific instead of this Y thing, we expect you will, you know, get a 3%, you know, lift in revenue. That feels to me very kind of dream state tough. I don't know.
I think the thing that's tough, and I'm channeling Matt Gershoff because he was helping with something the other night and he actually assigned me homework. Anyway, if you ask him a question, you will get
homework. You're not having to watch an entire linear algebra course on YouTube, are you?
No, okay. No. But it'll probably it's lead to that. But one of the things that you need to think about, because this actually happened to us recently, where we had a particular set of circumstances that happened during a campaign that led to us underperforming. And, you know, we're pretty confident that that's what caused it. And so there's kind of two camps going on where half of the business are saying, okay, well, we need to A/B test this so we can be sure that this is why we didn't perform as well, versus the other camp that's like, actually, we can be pretty confident. Like, this is not rocket science. Okay, there's a small chance that we might be wrong, but is it worth all of the effort of going through this huge A/B test, potentially giving half of our customers a worse experience just so that we can be certain that's what caused it? Like, it depends on your level of certainty. And in some cases, like, when you have a pretty bad customer experience, like, yeah, it's going to affect your sales. Like, that's not... Yeah. So I just think you've got to figure it out. And this, I do feel like at the moment, there's this thing where like everyone's like, we need to A/B test this. And I'm like, you need to A/B test some stuff. You don't need to test everything. You don't need certainty for everything. Some stuff, it's okay to know that there's a correlation and that probably drove that.
No, really what you should say is we don't need to A/B test it. We need to pump this through a deep learning algorithm and let that figure it out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think even that I think is something that is I have grown as an analyst that I think is more and more analysts are sort of putting it on themselves that if you say, great, we're not going to A/B test, we're going to, that means there's a little more uncertainty, but we're okay because we all agree this is a lousy experience, but we're going to deliberately not do, or we're going to fix that issue. And on the very next campaign, I'm going to look at it and then I'm going to make sure I close the loop with the business and say, look, we didn't test that. We saw this thing that sucked. We all agreed it was probably this. We changed it. I recently had a case where I'm like, I thought that I said, let's A/B test. Like, this has got to be, this is the issue, right? And everybody's like, oh yeah, that's terrible. We must fix that. And they're like, yeah, why A/B test? We'll just fix it. I'm like, okay, just fix it. Well, then they just fixed it. It didn't solve the problem at all. But that was on me to say, oh, you made the change. They were ready to say, checked off, we made the change, we fixed it. I'm like, no, the problem's still there. And that's another part of the analyst of also kind of being, if you make that decision, hey, we all agreed to this, let's make it. Okay, we've shifted to a less perfect, more of a longitudinal experiment as opposed to an A-B one. But let's figure out exactly what day we changed it. Let's, you know, see the next campaign. I will also say that I have used forecasting, and I've talked about this a lot, where I've used forecasting more for anomaly detection. I mean, that's that it, basically Adobe Sensei is using forecasting to do anomaly detection, but it's not actually predicting the future. It's predicting the past. So I still, that's still my go-to totally legitimate use of forecasting, but it has nothing to do with from today forward. It has to do with looking at yesterday or the last week and comparing it to what I should have expected for that. And I did not have any concept of that whatsoever a year ago. Well, maybe a year ago, 2 years ago. So that's coming in. But true prediction, the actual use case, I haven't had the light bulb go on as to where that fits.
As to why it's useful or to how it
fits. As to what the actual use case business need.
Okay, I've got one right now that we're working on. And someone told me the other day it's going to be really hard, so I'm a little bit worried. Thankfully, I'm not leading this piece of work. We're looking to do predictive CLV. So when a new user lands on your site, you can use a predictive model to determine what their likely CLV will be to try and understand how much you want to try and fight to keep this customer, essentially. Like, how much are you willing to incentivize them to stay with the platform?
And you, now I'm curious, you have to, that can't be when they just arrive and they're like, hey, I'm a new person, because you don't have enough data. Is that figuring out what you know, how many?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And like I said, thankfully, I'm not leading this piece of analysis, but I can provide you an update in a few months and see how it goes.
So that's fair. Like, take propensity modeling or attrition modeling is kind of the inverse of it. Absolutely. And maybe this actually gets back to, so I jumped right back to the aggregate world of, yeah, prediction. Nobody's asking me how much traffic's going to come to the site next week or how much revenue I'm going to generate. But
we totally get asked that, by the way. We always get asked, we've got a campaign next week. How much traffic can we expect? How many users can we expect? What's the ABV that we anticipate? 100%. We get asked that all the time.
That just seems like you're a very expensive resource to just head off. Is that for load balancing and or load management?
No. That's so that we can try and balance like how much stock goes on sale, whether we need to have a bigger incentive, how many email pushes and sends we do, how heavy we go into marketing. Like,
so that's actually
there are so many decisions that are based off that.
Predicting product demand. Forecasting, predicting, propensity modeling at a user level. Okay, so now I'm going to say I can probably come up with six totally legitimate, and even kind of I've seen them, even Mark Edmondson's thing from a year or so ago where predicting the next page so he could fire the prefetch tag, right? That's prediction. That's a very, very short-term prediction, but has a, you know, very applicable use case. So I basically just need to get out of my, you know, the questions that I would have been asking 5 years ago. And I totally see the value in.
Aren't recommendations a kind of prediction as well?
Yep.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
What? Come on. I came up with something actually valid. Okay.
I realized that came across as a meh, but it wasn't a meh. It was a, yeah, that is.
Oh, okay.
Very insightful point, yeah. Boss.
I've had it with you minimizing my contributions. To this podcast. No. Okay. Well, I had a question that is kind of off topic, but hopefully will not, we haven't gone too far past it that I can't bring it back up. You were talking about how you kind of do sort of multiple roles within, you know, your function. And you said data science and data analysis. How do you
and data engineering?
So how do you?
Some would say that's a subset of data science.
I'm asking Mo for a differentiation in her mind between data science and data analysis, just for the purpose of how you guys have defined it. Only honestly, for my own edification and maybe somebody
potentially
out there wants...
for employee feedback. Oh my God, this is not good.
No, to be honest,
I have no
actually...
idea how loaded this question is, Mo.
No, that is not true.
I was
true.
Talking about this last night, and it is something that I'm still trying to reconcile myself. I think that there is a perception in the market that happens too often that you become a data analyst, and if you're a little bit smarter, you work a little bit harder, you'll become a data scientist. And I actually get a little bit frustrated by that view. I think they have different roles. In my organization, those lines are very much more blurred than most organizations. Okay. But I would expect that a data scientist is doing a lot more machine learning, like predictive work, all that sort of stuff. An analyst would be a lot more around answering business questions, helping communicate that to the business, helping visualize it better. Like I haven't figured out the line exactly yet, but I'm still working on it.
Couldn't answering a business question be predictive?
It could be, but then I would expect that either our analyst would be delving into that data science space a little bit, or that our data science and analyst would be working together to do that.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's also like, how does those answers that you've gotten fit into your bigger strategy as a company? And I definitely see the analyst in facilitating that. Like, how do you work with your product managers, your marketers, and actually see that through to execution?
I'm secretly highly opinionated on this topic.
I think there are a lot of people highly opinionated, and some of them are in very, very, very different definitions.
Mm. Yeah, well, this is, I guess, what troubles me with some of the definitions I see bandied about is that it's sort of like they drop this demarcation between descriptive historical analytics and prescriptive or predictive analytics, as if that's the dividing line. And I just find that so faulty. So if you believe that and you're listening, you're wrong. Okay. Well, so
what do you think though?
Can I be really honest with you? I think that a data scientist is someone who has the potential to become hopefully a great analyst someday.
So can I give the definitive definition?
Go ahead, Tim.
A data scientist is a data analyst who works in the Bay Area. I did not come up with that, but I will say that. Classy. So there are definitely plenty of people. It's a term that's getting diluted. Like, we wanted it to be kind of this lofty thing, but it's sort of this weird sort of intersection of the tools being conflated with the role. So there are people who are really, really capable data engineers with SQL, Python, R, and Hadoop and Spark and all that. And they're like, I'm a data scientist. And some would say, well, you're a data engineer, which is a subset of data science. The description that I saw in lynda.com course, maybe, that had the Venn diagram that I kind of liked, that said a data scientist is the intersection of deep subject matter expertise, which I think is, Michael, where you were saying kind of they could become a good data analyst. Because I think a lot of data science, a lot of people talking about data science are saying we have to have subject matter expertise. We have to think like the business. But the intersection of that with computer science, programming, with statistics. And the funny thing with statistics is that statistics are both descriptive and predictive. Mm. And that little intersection, I think, is a classical or traditional analyst pursuing all of those. I actually am probably in decent shape on the subject matter expertise, but it's the computer science, which is the pursuit of R and now Python and SQL. I worked with all three over the weekend, and two of them not well, trying to learn them. And then the statistics piece, and those are like statistics and computer science. Those are not trivial things to bite off. I sort of like that definition. I get a little uncomfortable when it's like, ooh, when we go so lofty that we say you have to have a PhD, but I don't know. I don't have a definition. I think it's like big data. It's one of those that so many people have just defined it suits them, or as it suits somebody else who they know really well, who has told them what they should think. But I don't have any strong opinions.
All right, let's throw another level on top of all this. And actually, I love sort of this little mini discussion on data science, because that's like the little chewy thing in the middle of the candy on this episode. But yeah,
it's unexpected, like, but pleasantly surprising. So
what about the other one that I want to ask you guys about, which I'm calling causal inference? So it's not description, it's not prediction. It is, why did buying this product make a customer buy that product? Or does, I don't know, I'm trying to think of good scenarios that are examples of causal inference, but I feel like we do it all the time in analytics. And where does that live for you guys? And are there patterns emerged that you've seen there?
So I'll take a swing at it, because to me, when you had brought that up, so two things. When we say,
yeah, and by the way, that's totally going to be my last call too.
Okay.
So. Complete circle.
So the whole correlation is not causation, like, right, that's gets dropped all the time, sure. But that's what regression is supposed to be, that you do actually have independent. So I think there's a level of, when you move into linear or logistic regression, you're using hard numbers to try to actually have some linkage or causality. So put that in one bucket. And then the second, because the article you'd shared that sort of broke down data science into three buckets, but different three buckets from what I just shared, one of them being causal inference. And I thought, well, that seems to me like subject matter expertise, the stepping back and saying, huh,
oh, so, why might, so just that knowing how it works.
Well, but coming up with ideas of why it might have worked, and then you're feeding back into, okay, now what's the best way for me to prove? Like, I went and looked up read on Wikipedia and tried to really understand what, because it said, oh, causal inference is different from inference. And then I didn't quite understand what it said. Mm. It said. So to me, I sort of as like, isn't that critical thinking?
No, I don't think so. It's the process, because taken from Wikipedia really quickly, the process of drawing a conclusion about a causal connection based on the conditions of the occurrence of an effect. The main difference between causal inference and inference of association is that the former analyzes the response of the effect variable when the cause is changed.
Exactly why I did not understand.
But that doesn't... Yeah, but that doesn't mean it caused it, mean you can be confident that it caused it.
You're inferring a causation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, that's, like Tim said, I do think that's kind of like the use case that I was talking about before. Is like, okay, we're pretty confident that this is why this happened. It sounds like that's the same process, which does come down to, yeah, like being a subject matter expert or knowing your business inside and back to front, that you can be pretty comfortable with making that link.
Okay, because that's interesting, because in my last call, there's this data scientist guy who thinks it's an area that we should be studying in data science.
Mm. And which, so and it may be there's more rigor that could be had, and that may be the... So, huh?
What? I'm just laughing because I was like, we're going to end the show on a cliffhanger.
Yeah, this is a nerdy cliffhanger.
But I mean, I think the one of the examples I had earlier, where I'm like, look, I think from this on the mobile device, I looked at it and I inferred that the issue is,
right,
wow, this shitty mobile experience is now dead wrong. Like, I still would point to it, and I think all of us were like, yep, that's it. But we sort of fell into the trap of like, yeah, we're being a little oversimplistic. And if there are rigorous approaches or techniques to say, here's how you jump through that. I mean, I don't know if like analysis of competing hypotheses says,
right,
think about it first, document them. So you're probably doing some causal inference, but then you're taking the next step of saying, okay, now how do I validate that what I've inferred? How do I, you know, solidify,
yeah,
my confidence in that?
How do I disprove? That's actually kind of the opposite. How do I disprove what, mm-hmm, I've inferred?
Well, but what I think is interesting to me out of that is, I think this idea of inference or causal inference is very much grouped together with descriptive analytics or analysis generally in people's minds. I had never really separated the two in my own mind. I don't know if that just, I don't read enough, but, mm-hmm, that's just fine. Okay, we have not a lot of time, and we need to do a last calls, because whatever's going on with last calls is going to be amazing. So, Mo,
you want to start since you have a right in.
Let me tie this all up in a bow, and you guys can go skip to the answers. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, so there's a website of which I have a growing fascination and appreciation for called dataorigami.net. And one of their blog posts recently was this blog post written by Cameron Davidson Pylon. I don't even know if I'm saying that right. But he wrote this idea of the three pillars of data science: description, prediction, and causal inference. And so I was really fascinated with that. It dovetailed really nicely with kind of what we were thinking about as a topic. So I just shoved it in there. And that's my last call. All right.
All right, Tim, over to you.
Oh, okay then. So I am actually going to respond to Mo, your last call from episode 88, I think. Geez. So, because you had asked, you said, we've heard of This Week in Machine Learning, and you're like, I'm trying to find a good episode. Yes. And I cannot say that I am a diligent, super diligent listener to This Week in Machine Learning. I will say that I briefly met Sam Charrington at the Marketing Evolution Experience, went to the session that he recorded, and he is a delightful and very brilliant fellow. So, kind of related to this podcast, I did sort of sample a few of them and found one that wasn't, it was just from last month, kind of late June, I think. And I think he went to, so Pegasystems, you guys know, Pegasystem. So not Tyler, they're a big data company. They had some conference in Vegas. He went to it, did a series of podcasts, but one of them was with Vince Jeffs, who is the senior director of product strategy for AI and decisioning at Pegasystem, about omnichannel customer experiences. And it was just this kind of wonderful mix of sort of naive optimism about the potential future applications of AI mixed with a high degree of pragmatism. Topics like, you know, the creepiness factor got brought up. And you know what? The guy who's big into AI and machine learning was saying, you know what? Voice of the customer, trying to figure out what they're comfortable with, you know, totally makes sense. So that it was, I will post a link to it, but it was Omnichannel Customer Experience with Vince Jeffs on the This Week in Machine Learning and AI podcast. I think it's a good listen. It had a, he was a very, very pragmatic fellow while also telling a story that was actually kind of cool and exciting.
Nice.
All right, Mo, take us home.
Okay. So a few weeks ago, I went to an event that completely blew my mind. And I think it's really important we do a shout out. It's called She Loves Data, and they run free workshops for women who are either coming back into the workforce and have spent some time out of the data and analytics community, or women who are looking to transition and change careers into the data and analytics space. And there's actually also a third group, which they didn't necessarily target, but it's ended up happening, is that a lot of immigrant women who have amazing qualifications, who just have like these huge resumes full of experience and are entering the Australian market and kind of struggling to find work as well. So they run these free workshops. It's sponsored by Yellowfin, Kabula, AWS, Facebook, like the whole kit and caboodle. And I just met some of the most incredible women there. And if anyone is in the Asian area, they run workshops in Sydney, in Melbourne, in Singapore, kind of all over. And I've also met a whole group of amazing women that are looking for internships, they're looking for jobs. So if anyone is in that area and looking to bring someone onto their team, please let me know and I can intro you to seriously the most amazing group of women. And a huge shout out for the work that they're doing running these free workshops. It's pretty cool.
Awesome. If you've been listening to the show and you feel like Sean Connery meeting Jack Ryan in The Hunt for Red October, and you think our conclusions are all wrong, we'd love to hear from you. So get out your phone or your computer. Your experience may vary depending on which device you use, and come visit us on our website or on our Facebook page or on the Measure Slack. We'd love to hear from you. Well, I know that no matter how you analyze data, descriptive, predictive, causal inference with illusory superiority or data literacy or whatever it is, I know that for my two co-hosts, Mo and Tim, I'm confident in letting you know that we want you to keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to join the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or Measure Slack group. We welcome your comments and questions. Visit us on the web at analyticshour.io, facebook.com/analyticshour, or at Analytics Hour on Twitter.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
Okay, you guys ready? I'm ready. Let's do this.
I know how we like to ramble.
Well, you have an interesting life. Try to stick right on the mic, please.
Oh, is there news you want to share with the audience?
No, not that kind of engagement. Like, engaging personality. Well, when we ramble, it seems to work. Like, maybe we need to have this looser topic plan going forward and just talk shit.
I don't think we should plan for it. I think just when we're done and it happens, it'll be okay.
You're doing okay, kid. Stop stressing. Are you actually going to vacation, or are you going to do a bunch of stupid work?
And Michael forgot that he's muted.
Listen, she's about to come back and vacuum right next to the office, so we better hurry.
No. Hard stop.
That was a total fucking failure.
Rock flag and rambling topics.